Not that you were ever protected before, because Rabbi Goodman would spill the tea on you anyhow. No, I wouldn't. This week's class is, we'll do the quick overview of Parshat Vayikra. So we've left the books, the book of Exodus, which, as I mentioned in the Sunday Night Minyan, is a narrative book. It's full of stories. There's a linear progression of the Israelites from slavery to freedom and then to revelation of Sinai. And then we get Genesis, we get Leviticus, which is a book which is completely comprised of a whole bunch of rules that the Israelites have to follow that was given down at Sinai. You either love this stuff or you hate it, right? Rabbis generally love it, because if you were only into the narrative structure of Torah, that would be probably, you'd run out of interesting stuff to talk about. You'd get stuck in these later books. Vayikra and Devarim don't really have narrative structure. This week's Torah portion of Vayikra is almost completely comprised of sacrifices, what sacrifices you bring, when you bring them, and why. So for some people, that's exceedingly dull. The Hasidim are really going to be interested in this, of course. Tanya brought the key word that we're going to be using in a little bit, which is the word korban. Korban literally translates as the thing that you bring near, from the Hebrew word karov. But its best translation is either offering or sacrifice, depending on how you like to get down. So in this week's Torah portion, we're actually going to be looking at, we're going to be looking at the fourth verse in the entire Parsha and the last verse in the entire Parsha. I hope we have time, because the last verse has a text on it that is so crazy that I absolutely love it. And I hope that we have time to get to it. Okay, with that, we're going to do the text. We're taking a look at what you should have on your screen right now, but you can also pull up if you like. And I will make it large for all of you to see. And I'm going to post just the audio of this. So if you feel like, oh, I didn't put on my makeup today, don't worry, Joe. You don't need to powder your nose. You look all right. Okay. I think I should probably, before I get old, start using a little bit of concealer under here. Get those eyes nice and perky. Okay. Life in text, Vayikra 57, 81. Leviticus, chapter 1, verse 3. Im ola karbanu min hapakar zachar tamim yakrivena venu el petach ohel moed yakriv oto lirtsono lifne adonai. If one's offering is an ola, so an ola is a kind of an offering. Let me come back and explain that. If one's offering is an ola, offering from the herd, one shall make his offering a male without blemish. They shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting for acceptance on their behalf before the Lord. I changed all the words here to make them gender neutral, except that one. Darn it. Okay. They're still working on the gender neutral version of the Tanakh for Sepharia. It's not going to be out till later this year. So the thing that I wanted to introduce is there are a number of different offerings that are brought up in this week's Parsha. I remember reading somewhere that there are seven-ish different types of offering, but that's not entirely correct, because there's really like 9 or 12, depending on how you subdivide them. Some of them are specific offerings only for certain days. Like the mention that I said of the different offerings, of saying there are seven different offerings, does not include the offering that you all may know of and might be thinking of the most at this time of year, which is the Pesach offering, right? So there's an asham, which is a guilt offering, a vadai offering, which is a different type of guilt offering. And sometimes it's known as the asham vadai offering, because they may be one and the same. There's the olah offering. There's an offering called a re'ayon offering, which is an appearance offering for the three festivals when you would appear. There was a special thing that you brought just those three times of year. There are offerings for daily sacrifices. There's the shacharit, the mincha, and the ma'ariv offering. there's finally an additional offering from the daily offerings that is brought on Shabbat, which we call the Musaf, right? So for those of you who go to a conservative synagogue, you're familiar with all those terms because the rabbis flipped up the offerings at the temple and made the Shacharit, Musaf, Mincha, and Ma'ariv offerings into prayers instead, right? So we pray instead of bringing a bullock, a lamb, a ram, a turtle dove, or a fine cake flour of what's called solet to the temple, okay? So that's kind of a long-winded explanation of all these different things. Back to the word olah. So the olah offering is translated often by the JPS as the burnt offering. And the reason is, unlike a lot of the other offerings, so the offerings were basically like you took a cow, you brought it to the temple, you handed it off, you went around to the side window, they slaughtered the cow, and they gave you like 80% of it, right? They butchered it for you. And you popped around to the drive-through window, which it literally was. The place that you dropped off the bullock and the place that you picked up the offering were different windows, right? Very clever. Drive-through, invented by the Torah back in the first and second temple days. I'll add another thing that I say a lot when we talk about offerings in a second. But you would get 80. So when people say like, oh, you barbaric Jews with your pre-modern ideas, you slaughtered animals and burned them as an offering to God, how wasteful. That's a misunderstanding of how offerings work. Back in the day, the way offerings worked was you butchered it and you took the inedible portions, the hind quarters, the sinew, the bones, stuff that you couldn't eat anyways, and you burned it on the altar. In addition, the priests would take 10%, as no pun intended, they're cut, right? They literally got 10% of all of the offerings because they were butchering them anyways. They did all the labor. Of course, they should get some sort of payment, right? Additionally, for those of you who are aware of the New Testament, if you had to come down to make an offering at the temple and you did not want to haul your cattle from the north of Israel or from Alexandria or from Rome, which are places where Jews were living in that time, you could change your money, come to the temple, get to the front and go to the table of the money changers and pay your Greek drachmas or your Egyptian, whatever the Egyptian coin was at that time. And you could exchange the money and buy a cow or a turtle dove or a ram or a lamb or whatever. And you get it at the table of the money changers. And you know the story in the New Testament of Jesus overturning the table of the money changers is that some of those guys were speculating and charging exorbitant fees. And Jesus got upset and flipped over the tables. But like Jesus was a good Jewish boy. He would have gone to the temple in desiring of offering and offering. The last thing I was going to say is that the temple, especially at the festival holidays, they burned a lot of incense and they played music. The Levites were the house band for the temple. And the reason that they burned a lot of incense, not only is because the Torah commands it, but also because the smell of animals being slaughtered is really gross. And if you burn enough incense, people won't notice it. And the sound of animals being slaughtered is pretty awful. So if you have a house band drowning out the sounds of the animals being slaughtered, you've got something nice going on there. So you've got barbecue, you've got funny smells, and you've got rock music. Basically, this is Coachella, right? This is Lollapalooza, right? Funny smells. Maybe this joke would work better for you guys if I used Woodstock as my analogy. Okay, anyways, Renee liked the Woodstock joke. Okay, moving on. So the olah offering is the only one which is fully consumed. It was actually not butchered. It was an offering that was brought to the temple, slaughtered, and then you took the whole of the animal and you burned it, right? So it's fairly wasteful and not very common, in fact. But more importantly, for our Hasidic purposes, all of that was prologue. None of it's going to be used by the Hasidim. The word olah means going up, okay? So that's really important. Olah means going up. And korban means not only offering, but it also means drawing close. So how do you draw close to God? You make an offering. So olah, going up, korban, drawing close. That's the important thing to remember when we read this text. So we're going to get a really old school. This is first generation Hasidut, back to the OG, the Magid of Mezrich, who was contemporaries with the Baal Shem Tov. died in 1772 and lived in the town of Meserich, which is right next to the town that the Baal Shem Tov lived in. Okay, he writes, if one's offering is an olah, it will be brought for acceptance before God. So a fairly perfunctory line in the Torah, right? Like, burn this offering and it will be accepted by God. And he's going to flip it up and just get really specific into this. And he's going to deal with the idea of the korban being ritzono lifnei Adonai, lirtzono lifnei Adonai, the final three words in there, right? That it will be, the translation in Hebrew here for the Torah is for acceptance before God. But lirtzono translates as to the desire before God. So one thing that you might ask here is, what does it mean for God to desire it? And the answer that the Maggid of Meserich is basically going to make is lirtzono is to his desire or to its desire. And so the Maggid is going to flip the script and say, rather than it being about God's desire, it's going to be about our desires, which gets into Paula, you know, what are your desires? Like, what do you want, right? Okay. I said that because Paula had reached for a nice glass of red wine at exactly the moment. Not red wine?
No, tonic water and cranberry juice.
Very good, very good. It looks like you're drinking red wine, though, in the middle of the day.
It's all sugar-free.
Right. Very good. So, okay. So he says this, if one elevates, olah, one offers themselves. So he's playing here. He's playing with the double meanings of these words. If a person desires to raise oneself up from a lowly madrega, from a lowly spiritual state, to raise themselves up and to transcend, that's the Hebrew word there is lehit romem, to be romemu is to be like lofty, but I didn't have a good verb for the word lofty. I thought about loftify, but I'm sure none of you would like that. So I use transcend here. To raise themselves up and transcend, quote, be brought for acceptance before God, one should bring their own desires before God. Yakriv et retzono lifnei Adonai. So he flips up this meaning of like what it means to be, what God's desires are, and says, no, forget God's desires. Talk about your desires. So the Maggid is also playing with this other idea that we have regarding desire and bringing before God, which is back in the old days, you slaughtered an animal and you brought it to God. We don't do that anymore. We haven't done that for thousands of years. The rabbis of the Talmud flipped all the offerings into prayer. So the question becomes, when you come before God in prayer, what do you want, right? What do you want? What are you seeking? What do you desire? And I think that the whole thing kind of gets back to our own motivations and our own desires. So when you are at prayer, at synagogue, or at home, right? The question is, what are you praying for? Why are you praying for it? And what are your intentions and your motivations? This is so classically Hasidic. It's the core of the Hasidic idea, which is that in prayer and in study, intent matters. Meditation matters. Meaning matters. Desire matters, right? Going through the motions does not work. You should snap out of it. Snap out of it, said Sharon in Moonstruck. You should snap out of it every once in a while and realize your motivations. Or, to use another word, analyze your motivations. Like, step back and say, like, what is my ritzon? What's my desire here? One should bring their own desires before God. The Maggid is playing here and saying, like, listen, lowly people on a lowly level, they just kind of muck through it. They just kind of keep going through the motions. To raise yourself up, you've got to analyze your own desire. You've got to think about what it is that you're bringing. Like, what are you bringing? All right. So there's a story here, which is super weird. And you might not like it because it goes in a direction that, you know, is very what's called musar. It's much more ascetic in its outlook, but I think that the core of it is still really interesting. And it's from another of our OG Hasidim. So the Chose of Lublin, the Seer of Lublin, is second generation Hasidic. So he would have been a student literally of the Maggid of Meserich, which is the guy before. And the Torah, the text goes like this, V'siper ha-chazon me Lublin, Ahozemi Lublin. And it's a wild story. One time, on a cold winter's night, Tsar Napoleon laid in a tent with his conscripts on the ground, covered in many blankets. I had to remind myself what the Hebrew word for blanket was. I forgot. He became very thirsty for, I don't know why it says wanter, water. But because of the cold, he was loath to get out from under the blankets. We can assume he's like, you know, trying to conquer Russia in this story. Until he said to himself, if this is so, you are a lazy man, Napoleon. Atslan ata, Napoleon. And what makes you better than others? Immediately, he jumped up from his prone position and went into the field to the place of the water barrel. When he got there, he thought, for just a little water, I struggled as such and was unable to overcome my thirst. If so, how am I better than all of other mortals? He did not drink and immediately returned to his bed. Paul is like, what an idiot. This story, and then, so the Jose of Lublin finishes. The assumption here maybe is like, this is his like meaning of the whole story. He finishes with, this story I call the breaking of desire, Shvirat Ratzon. Okay, so what the heck is going on here? So he writes a story that is related to the last piece, and our commentator links the two. Although it may have been that the Jose of Lublin actually originally taught the text that we learned before about desire, and then puts it here. So the question about the word ratzon, of desire, and how we bring our desires to God, the question here is, when are our desires worthy? And when are they not, right? And I'm gonna be like the TV show Law and Order, which used to claim that they were ripped from the headlines, right? Law and Order, if you were a writer for Law and Order, you had the laziest, easiest job in the world. You saw what was in the news. You saw the most titillating, absurd, ridiculous story in murder and theft and homicide and graft and whatever. And you sat down at your computer and you banged out a 44-minute teleplay of a version of that. And then you put two cops on the beat and then bada bing, bada boom, you were done. So this week, we've got one of the latest in our many stories of the Me Too movement jumping up to bite dumb men in the ass, which is, of course, Governor Cuomo in New York is in trouble for having sexually harassed up to possibly six of his female aides, right? So why am I bringing this up? This story I call The Breaking of Desire. So men in and women also, but I'm going to pick on men because I'm one of them. We have lust in our hearts and we have desire and we see an attractive individual and we sometimes can't restrain ourselves from letting whatever stupid thought in our brains creep out into our behavior. We can't, you know, for lack of a better term, keep it in our pants. And Governor Cuomo may be claiming, I'm going to pick on him now, and you might want to defend him. That's your prerogative. It's fine. He might be claiming that he only walked up to a female aide and put his hand on her shoulder or gave her a long, lengthy hug or a kiss on the head. Apparently, kissing on the head is a thing that he does. And he meant it innocently and he didn't do anything. But that being said, I will make the argument that some of men's behaviors are born out of ratzon, out of desire, the way the Jose of Lublin is framing it. And rather than controlling our desire, sometimes men act on it. And that's a lack of ability of shvirat ratzon, an inability to be breaking of the desire. That's the kind of thing we're talking about in the story with Napoleon, right? What's the illustrated text that the Jose of Lublin is doing with the story of Napoleon? How much damn self-control do you have, right? You guys have probably heard me go on this rant if you've been in this class for 2 years. But one of the things that I say, one of the things that frustrates me about the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, one of the things that frustrates me about all fundamentalist religious communities is they have this strain in them where they say to themselves, women should dress more appropriately and dress chastely because otherwise they draw the lure of men and men's eyes will, and they make men think lusty thoughts. And I think, dumbass, what are you talking about? Right? Like, if you see, if I, Rabbi Goodman, sees a pretty girl on the street dressed in a very, you know, like not wearing a lot of clothing, it's my obligation to be controlling my desire. I have to be Shvirat Ratzon. I have to think what I need to think, which is there is another individual human being on the street, a lofty soul going through the day, who also is dressed in a way in which will allow her to not be hot in the summer sun, right? That's it, right? She's dressed that way because it's hot, period. That's it. Or she's dressed that way because she's dressed that way. That's it. That's the only reason, right? It's really simple. We have to be Shvirat Aratzon. We have to be, and by the way, I only use that thing as my parallel, right? As my illustrative lesson. For you to walk away from this lesson and say like, well, I'm not a man, so I don't need to worry about this Shvirat Ratzon. That's not the point. The point is all of us have desires which are not bound up in a better ulterior motive, right? Like we all think or have feelings, thoughts, beliefs that we have not fully analyzed and we have not necessarily broken ourselves of, right? Hobgoblins of little minds or negative patterns of behavior that we need to break. And that's the Tsar Nicholas, the Tsar Napoleon story, right? You have to, I'm not saying, Paula, because you were the one who laughed at this story about the water, I'm not saying that you need to have the kind of self-control that you force yourself out of bed when it's cold because you need to, and then force yourself not to drink, right? The illustration of the story is, are you controlled by your lesser desires? And if so, are you aware of it, right? What are your base desires that are not, that you're not dealing with? And can you control them, right? Are you the kind of person who says, I'm really depressed, I'm gonna eat a whole cake, right? Maybe like there's nothing wrong with eating and drinking to, you know, a normal state, but like, what are the desires that you have? There are people who are workaholics. There are people who have an addiction to exercise because they think it makes them feel better about themselves. Are we aware of our internal ratzon or of our motivations? And are we capable of shvirat ratzon, of breaking those motivations? Okay. Any comments or thoughts on this? These two texts before? This is a good text. Rich was asked in the text. You could have unmuted, but it's good. So Rich is asking, how is the Napoleon story related to the Parsha? So the riff is this. The Napoleon story is playing on the word ratzon. The Jose of Lublin is connecting his line about breaking desire to the quote from above of the Magid of Meserich. And the Magid of Meserich is playing with the question, what is your ratzon? What are your desires? So the first question is, back to our question in this class, what is your desire and is it a holy motivation? And then the flip side of it is the thing that the Jose of Lublin brings, which is, do you have desires which are not good motivations and can you break them? Which is really good. This is really good addiction Torah. You know, if you were a person who was in a substance abuse program, this might be a kind of a useful idea of like, although it's maybe too simple, which is like, are you in control of your desires and can you break them? And so forth. Tanya says she I'm just acknowledging what Tanya asked. She said she can't hear everything. Yes, there is a recording. When I'm done, I'll throw it up on the website, which is rabbimarkashergoodman.com. If you're all bored, you can go and look there. Any other questions or comments on this text? Renee, do you have your hand up? Or is this left over from last time? I can lower your hand. I have the power, right? I'm not drunk with the power though, because that would be giving into my ratzon. Okay, very good. Really interesting kind of play here. But I think the thing that's really neat about this text, I just remembered that I say that all the time. One of the things that's neat about this text is like how far afield it is from the literal text, right? Remember when I started this, I was talking about an offering that a dude in the desert brings to the Ohel Moed to burn to God, right? And we actually wind up talking about, like, do you have control of your desires? And how the Hasidim get from point A to point Z is fascinating. And the ulterior question of, do they really believe that this is genuinely what the Torah is talking about? Or are they trying to teach a moral lesson and they're going to find a hook to get there? You know, this is like when you see a rabbi giving a sermon in synagogue, and you're like, how do you get that out of the Torah portion? Or did Rabbi Adelson just want to like go on a rant about whatever's in the news this week? The answer is the Hasidim have been doing this for hundreds of years. We stand on the shoulders of giants. Okay, we'll do the last text, which is a long walk. If you guys like, we've done a couple texts. The Me'a Shiloach, the super trippy guy that I like to talk about. If you thought this last text was a long walk, wait till you see this one. If you guys like the long walk texts, then this one's a winner. If you don't like the long walk texts, then this one will frustrate you. Okay. But it's a good one. So this text is from the last verse in this week's Torah portion. In fact, you can see that it's the last verse because in the Hebrew, it ends with this little parenthesis here and a little pay. And that when I'm teaching you a little by-the-by thing. Oh, I forgot one other thing that I'll say in a second. Let me explain this thing about the pay, and then I'll say one thing about the Napoleon thing. The pay is a thing that shows up in some Torah translations, which tells you that the line in a Sefer Torah itself is petucha, meaning it's an open-ended line, which means that, like, instead of just writing text all the way to the margin, a petucha tells you that the Torah scribe stops writing here and stops writing till the end of the line, which also generally occurs when you get to the end of a Torah portion. It's like new paragraph, right? There was a thing I wanted to say about the Napoleon story before we go on, which is the Napoleon story is part of a genre of Hasidic and 18th century, 19th century texts, which is building off of a whole series of stories that the Talmud also has about Caesar. So I don't think it's a coincidence that they use the word Tsar Napoleon as opposed to Emperor Napoleon, because the Hebrew is basically the same for Caesar and Tsar. And you probably already knew this, but the word Tsar is just the Russian word for Caesar. Okay. You might be asking the question, why do we have this weird story about Napoleon and what are the odds that this actually happened? The answer is there's almost zero chance that this story actually happened to Napoleon, right? The rabbis of the Talmud made up stories about Caesar all the time in which there's almost 0% chance that those stories also happened. The Talmud has all these stories where Caesar interacts with the rabbis of Rome or the rabbis of ancient Palestine. The odds that the Caesar and the rabbis actually ever talk to each other is like 0.001. It's possible, but highly unlikely. And it's a whole genre of stories, which I'm sure somebody has a PhD in asking the question, why do the rabbis invent stories with important, powerful leaders? And the answer is, guys, if I ever get invited to the White House and I get to meet Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, you know I'll tell you about it in this class because I'll be so damn excited about the experience. I may not have anything to tell you other than the fact that the kosher pastrami at the White House is unbelievable, right? Or that I got a selfie with Joe Biden's dog, right? Like those, but that's my expectation, which is that the rabbis throw these stories in because being close to power kind of elevates the story, okay? So that's probably why the Hasidic rabbi tells a story about Napoleon, because it's interesting and illustrative, even if it probably never happened. Okay, that's my little side piece. Back to the final line. Leviticus 5:26, the priest shall make expiation on his behalf before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven for whatever he may have done to draw blame thereby. First thing, I almost never use the pronoun he in the Torah unless I'm referring to an obvious individual who is male. It is very obvious, of course, that the individuals in the temple back several thousand years ago were all going to be male. There were no female Kohanim, right? So Kohanot. Today, there's a whole program in it called Kohenet, which is a women's priesthood Jewish institute. We have a local Kohenet here in Pittsburgh, whose name is escaped me right now, but she's really, really great. Really focused on religion and ritual as opposed to text study, because that's what the Kohenet Institute does. Not related. The priest shall make expiation on his behalf before the Lord. So we're talking about when you sin, you bring an asham offering to the priest at the Ohel Moed, at the tent, and he'll slaughter the offering and you'll be forgiven, right? So there's a two-step process. You bring the offering, you bring it to the priest slaughters it, you get forgiven, okay? So there's like kind of this whole little process. Again, for our Hasidic rabbis, we're not so interested in the process of how sacrifice and offering happened 2,000 years ago when the temple still stood. We're interested in what can I do with this text? So before we go forward, you have to look at the Hebrew. Look at these two final words, okay? And I'll point something out to you. So the final two Hebrew words here are le'ashma ba, le'ashma va, okay? Which translates as blame thereby, blame thereby. The word asham is, and the asham offering was a guilt offering, right? So you will be expiated for your guilt, for your blame. And blame thereby, or your guilt thereby, would be a good translation. So this is funny because we're ending the Torah portion on two words which aren't super great, right? It's like, you know, the final line of the Torah portion is this, guilt, right? And so the question is, if you ended the Torah portion on the word guilt, how would everybody in the congregation feel? And the answer might be not so good. There's a parallel throughout Jewish literature where we generally don't want to do that. One, the one that I know the best, although it occurs throughout all the Haftorahs, although not, I can't think of one off the top of my head specifically, but there's one that I do know very well. When we read the word, the Book of Lamentations on Tisha B'Av, the Book of Lamentations deals with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and the kind of the violence and the horrible things that took place there. And the last line of the Book of Echa is really sad. It's a Debbie Downer line. It's a bummer, right? And so rather than the rabbis leaving us on that line, they actually make us go back to the second to the last line, and we do it again. Chashivenu Adonai venashuva chadesh yameinu kekedem. Return us to you, O Lord, and we shall be renewed, which is a thing we also say when we close the ark, right? Chadesh, chadesh yameinu, chadesh yameinu kekedem, which also appears at the end of Echa, right? But that's not the last line of Echa. We tacked on the second to last line underneath the last line because we did not want to leave on a down note, okay? Blame thereby, guilt, right? We don't want to do that. The whole, now that you understand that, this whole thing is going to make a lot more sense. The Maor V'Shemesh, Kolonimus Kalman Halevi Epstein, who died in 1825, lived in Poland. In the name of the holy rabbi, Rabbi Mendel of Rimanov, who's Rabbi Menachem Mendel Torim of Rimanov, who died in 1815, brought the custom that when the Torah portion of Parshat Vayikra was concluded, le'ashma ba, guilt, right? Blame thereby. In order to not conclude the Parsha on a bad note, his congregation would get up, like literally they would come, they would stand up is what it says in the Hebrew, and call out loudly, La'el Asher Shabbat Mikol Hama'asim B'Yom HaShvi'i, which translates as, to God who completed the work of creation on the seventh day, which I was like, I know this line, but I don't remember where this line is. So I went and looked it up, which I'll explain in a second, but that line, Le Asher Shabbat Mikol Ha Maasim Beyom Hashvi'i is an acronym for La Ashma Ba. If you take the first letter of each of those words, It spells out La'ashmaba. You might be wondering to yourself, how does the ah at La'ashma get there? And it's because a ha can be in Hebrew, it can be read the opposite way, right? It can be read as ah, especially if it ends a word, right? You all know that because Rosh Hashanah is Rosh Hashanah, not Rosh Hashanah, right? Because it ends with a hey, but we don't aspirate the hey, we put an ah into it. Okay, but you all knew that. So I had to look up this line, right? What is this acronym? Where did the rabbi get this line? La'el asher shabbat mikol ha-ma'asim b'yom ha-shvi'i. Because it sounded immediately to me, like a line where the blessing that we do on a cup of wine on Shabbat, right? Yom HaShishi, Vayichula HaShamayim, and then we get to talking about Yom HaShvi'i, but it's not that line. It's close, but it's out of order and there's a couple different words. So I had to go and look it up, and I looked it up, and you can see down at the note at the bottom of the page. It's in our prayer book. It's on Sim Shalom's, the Slim Shalom, the Shabbat morning one, not the fatter gray blue one. It's on page 109. It's the prayer we do right after El Adon and right before Ahava Rabbah. And it would start out El Asher Shabbat Mikol Ma'asim B'Yom HaShvi'i, right? And we just launch back in. It's kind of a minor prayer. It's kind of a minor line. I would never have noticed it had I not had to go and look it up. But it says, the translation is, to God who completed the work of creation on the seventh day. Okay. So he's done a neat thing, which is he said, like, let's take a crappy line. Let's take a crappy word that ends the parsha and make it happy. And he does a thing, which I hate generally, which is he throws in an acronym, right? Which is like, I hate it because it feels like a long walk, right? It feels like, is that really what Torah means here? But I think there's something really cool about taking a negative and flipping it to a positive. I think it's really pretty and really cool. All right, the long walk gets longer. He's going to get a little far afield here, and I like it. I think it's trippy and crazy. He keeps going. He's trying to now connect the idea of Shabbat and the ma'aseh of the creation of God back to ashma, of guilt, right? That's a long walk, but he tries to get there. And the guy we're talking about is neither the Maor v'Shemesh or Rabbi Mendel of Rimanov. It's a guy who I really like by the name of the Pella Yoetz. And the Pella Yoetz is the only rabbi I've ever studied who was from Bulgaria. I literally have learned a lot of rabbis before, and I've never, ever seen another guy in Bulgaria. So if you ever go to Bulgaria and you go to the town of Sisamov, I think is where he's from, or Silamov, I forget, go look up the grave of the Pella Yoetz. Okay, he says this. And I saw one of the great rabbis hold by this custom. For the purpose of resting on Shabbat is to return the act of creation to the one that fashioned the creation. It's a phrase for God I've never heard before. The Yotzer Breshit, the one God is, the one that fashioned the creation. For God created the universe and gave the earth to humans to till and to tend, which is a quote from Genesis 2. And then he says, and also, Va'aretz natan li bnei adam, right? Va'aretz natan li bnei adam, lo ha-meitin yechallelujah. You know it from Hallel, but it's also known as Psalm 115. And on Shabbat, it is returned to by the people, Israel, to its creator, to make us aware that all of the creation is part of God. So he does a really neat move here, which I really, really like, which is to say, and I've never thought of Shabbat this way before. I mean, I'm sure I've thought of Shabbat sort of this way, but not really. He's thought of Shabbat in a really cool way, which is the purpose of Shabbat is to return the earth to God, right? To be like, yo, I know you made this. I'm a chill and I'm just going to relax and it's yours, right? And more importantly, I'm going to recognize that I'm returning it to you, right? The earth is yours. The metaphor that I often make when I'm talking about Shabbat is when I walk to synagogue on Shabbat, back in the days when we used to walk to synagogue on Shabbat, I will see trash on the street because we live in Squirrel Hill and there's trash everywhere and or it's windy. And I remind myself, because I like picking up trash, because it's a good thing to do for the universe, I look at the trash on Shabbat and I say, God put the trash there. It is not my job to return the earth to some other state than the state that it is in right now. The earth is perfect. It does not belong to me. It is God's. I return it to God on this day, right? Shabbat is the day that we recognize that it ain't ours, right? Even the house that you paid the mortgage off on, it ain't yours. You can't take it with you, okay? Which is a cool idea. And that creation, that recognizing creation and the creator is part of Shabbat. He goes a little deeper on this. However, one that swears falsely, they deny that the Holy One, blessed be, the Kodesh Baruch Hu, God, is the creator. God is the fashioner. And that everything of God is blessed. So he's tying three neat ideas together, right? Which is Shabbat, God, and creation. And he's saying, the Pele Yoetz is saying, you gotta kind of hold it all together, man. God, Shabbat, creation, they're all one. They're all kind of living symbiotically. And if you start to deny one, if you deny that God is the creator and that the creation is part of God, then you are guilty, guilty of swearing falsely. That's the, you're like, Rabbi Goodman, that was a long walk. I'm like, yo, I know, but that's how we get here, okay? So he's tying the idea of Shabbat, which is that phrase, to the word guilty, by saying if you deny the creator and the creation, then you bear the guilt. And that's the whole riff on the word, le'asher Shabbat mikol ha'ma'asim b'yom ha'shvi'i, as an acronym of la'ashmaba. Let me finish it off. Thus, when one does teshuvah, when one repents and apologizes to God, when one goes before the priest and brings an asham offering and pays the penalty price of a fifth, by the way, back in the day when you stole something, you in order to keep people from stealing things or from damaging and defaming other people, right? Let's assume that you stole your neighbor's car, right? If the original law was that you shall return it without penalty, then people will be like, yo, I got caught this time, but I'm gonna steal more cars because if I don't get caught, I got a free car, right? So they created a penalty. And the penalty was financial. And the financial penalty was chomesh, which means one-fifth, meaning you stole some dude's $100,000 Maserati, you give him back the Maserati when you're caught, and you owe him $20,000, okay? So the idea somehow gets transmogrified into the modern idea of doing tshuva. I don't know what he means here when he talks about paying a penalty price of a fifth while doing tshuva. My assumption is, you know, your local rabbi, when you do something really bad, might advise you to give tzedakah, but I don't know. And pays the penalty price of a fifth and brings an asham offering, which is the other offering that would have been brought at the temple times. So maybe the chomesh he's talking about is only in temple times and he's kind of jumped backwards in time. Thus atonement is done for them by the Kohen, by the priest, and they are forgiven. And then he kind of finishes with his line, to God who completed the work of creation on the seventh day, right? So your guilt is in maybe ascribing the world is less than belonging completely to God. And you get right with God by fully recognizing le'el asher, I got to find the Hebrew again, Shabbat mikol ha'ma'asim b'yom ha'shvi'i, right? That's his crazy little move. I just like that he does a thing where he takes a negative at the end of the parsha and flips it up to a positive. I also like the fact that like you guys could read through this week's Torah portion in synagogue and be bored out of your skull and get to this final line about like sacrifices and priests and offerings and be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sacrifices, priests, offerings, and be like, I know a secret. I know a secret. And the secret you know is that there's a little cool acronym that's tucked into the middle of the prayer. The other thing is when the next time you see La'el Asher Shabbat Mikol HaMasim Bayom HaShvi'i, you'll think of this line from Vayikra. All right, that's what I got. I'll take questions now, and then we'll call it a day. Because some of you are like, wow, that was great. That text was really amazing and really interesting. And those of you are like, I don't know what just happened. 19 things just hit me in the head and I didn't understand a damn one of them. But that's okay. Tanya, you are up. If we can hear you. There we go. Maybe.
Okay. Well, I think I kind of get it because can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I think I kind of get it because the whole idea to me of the Mishkan is finished. It starts off and he called to Moses. Okay. Now all of these korbanot are about restoring the relationship because Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, a blessed memory, said that the whole concept of the Mishkan was a tikkun and it's been finished. And now God has his house and he's inviting people to come in. And in order to fix this broken relationship between God and man, there is the korbanot. It's like some people, when they make their wife mad, they bring them flowers. And that's just a really simplified example. So I think bringing all these offerings and all these korbanots is just a way of man repairing his relationship with God and also repairing his relationship with other people. Because some of these restitution offerings and things, you broke something, the relationship is broken, and now you have to make restitution and restoration. And that's kind of the way I see it.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. And I threw a phrase in there that I remember originally hearing probably when I was young and then kept hearing over and over again throughout popular media and just being kind of adjacent to the kind of Black Baptist and AME tradition, right? Which is occasionally you'll hear in Black and predominantly Black churches, the phrase to get right with God. Right? You got to get right with God. And I love that phrase when it comes to the korban, right? That like the notion of the korban is get yourself right with God. And one of the ideas of getting right with God in the way that it's done here is the literal idea of a sacrifice. You take a thing that's you screwed up, okay? You take a thing that's valuable to you and you say, because of my pride, my avarice, my greed, my lust, name one of the seven deadly sins, right? Or something else. I done wrong and I am out of favor with God and I need to get right. And in order to get right, I need to bring a thing and sacrifice it, right? I need to take something of financial value to myself and get rid of it. We don't really have an analog in the modern Jewish world. It would be nice if we did. A parallel, a possibility is that financial donation could be seen as a nesham. You know, one of the questions that I think I have often morally asked myself is, if you have a person who's committed a grievous sin, is giving a lot of tzedakah to the Jewish community a restitution of that? You know, the paradigmatic example for Los Angelinos is Michael Milken, who is actually a family friend of ours. Fern Milken and my grandmother, Annette Goodman, used to play bridge every week. And Fern, I think, has passed away. But Fern's son, Michael, worked for Drexel Burnham Lambert. And Drexel Burnham Lambert was involved in these very speculative stock stuff, which is highly illegal. And Michael wound up doing 9 years in prison for creating financial devices, which were so unstable that they were guaranteed losers. Junk bonds, they were called. And I am not financially smart enough to fully explain that completely. But anyways, Milken got out of prison and he gave a lot of money to the Jewish community, including a school at the top of Bel Air called the Milken School, right? And the question is that okay? Is he right with the world, with the universe? And the answer is, I don't know, but you know, I think the idea still stands there. He's gone right. I mean, like at this point, we're like 25 years on past his time in prison. It would be unfair to pick on him and say, you know, you can never repent for this. That being said, like we should ask that question about Bernie Madoff, who defrauded and took away millions of dollars from people. Like, how do you get right? How does he get right? It's a bigger question. Here, the Hasidic take is you get right with God by making sure you ascribe things to God, including creation and Shabbat. All right, I think Phil has his hand up. So go ahead, Phil.
Just real quick, I wanted to thank you all because, can you hear me? Okay, no, I just wanted to thank you all because I studied today with you in honor of a friend of mine who passed away 6 years ago on this day. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, what was his or her name, if you can share?
Eric Steinthal of blessed memory. Melech Yosef? I don't know. Melech was his Hebrew first name. My daughter's middle Hebrew name, Mayim, is in his honor.
Can you share with us maybe one thing you learned from him or a memory you have of him that like you can bless us with? It'll kind of like, just a thought.
First of all, I can't believe I just said 6 years ago because my daughter's going to turn 8. So it was 9 years ago. Holy shit. Excuse me. I learned from my friend Eric a lot about being the quiet observational one, taking everything in and learning without being loud. And I learned a lot about believing in myself conference-wise from my friend Eric. He was my best buddy at Camp Ramon, the Berkshires, like since I was 10. You know, we played a lot of basketball together and he was always better than me, but he always thought I was better than I was. And it led to me being a lot better.
That's huge. Thank you for that. I think it's really valuable to take the Torah of life too, that like you can learn a lesson from a person who's passed on, and like that their instruction can be of an instruction to all of us. You know, we give Eric a little bit of life today by kind of thinking about, you know, how we can learn Torah in his memory, but also like what his Torah was, like what he brought out to the universe. So
yes,
thanks for that, Phil.
Thank you guys.
That's a great note to end on. I hope you guys are doing well. Enjoy the sunshine. 65 degrees today in Pittsburgh and sunny. The only downside of it is it's such a nice day. We're all encouraged to go out and do all of the gardening, which we may have to do after all the snow has melted, all the leaves and all the junk and stuff like that. So, all right, I'm going to turn off the recording. Tanya has a question. You guys can bounce if you need to go. And I'll see you at Shul on Shabbat because I'm giving the sermon this week at Beth Shalom. I'll try not to do a repeat of this class. I don't know how the heck I would give a sermon off of the three texts we learned today. A long, long walk, but it's a good thing. All right. Thank you all.